Hey guys, welcome back to an episode of UAP Studies Podcast. We're back in full swing, Michael. We're coming out with episodes every Sunday.
Sometimes,
and then sometimes we record two episodes. I think we got us booked for several recordings per day, but today we only have one, which is awesome because it's going to be an in-depth look into more of the history of UAPs, UFO, Foo Fighters.
I'm excited about that.
It's not an area of expertise on my part, and I mentioned that to Graham that it's something I need to be educated on a little bit because I don't know my history as much as I should like to know, and I think it's good to have an expert like him that wrote I think it's like 4 or 5 books on the subject. He's doing it every 2 years, like you know, starting from the 40s to all the way to the 50s. Now I think he's doing, and it's crazy because the amount of activity and what's recorded, the data that's out there, the research that people like Grandma's done over the years is overwhelming. You could convict
a lot of data pour over, a lot of documents and
You could convict a man. You could convict a man to death with the evidence that we have so far. You know what I mean? Like if you look at it that way, that's why denial and omissions from the gatekeepers is so insulting. It's like, I know everybody could see the elephant in a room, but it's like, you guys are crazy. There's no elephant. Like it's
never an elephant.
Yeah. So without further ado, Graham, welcome to the podcast. It's an honor to have you here. I got my cup of coffee ready because my voice is still a little bit, I started smoking again. I apologize. It does this to my voice. So I realize it's
their life choices.
Just guys, I told you not to emulate me. I'm nobody to emulate. Horrible habits, coffee and smoking. I got a short lifespan, I swear to God. But while I'm here, this is what we do, the podcast, and it's to learn from people like Graham about the history of UFO. So Graham, you've been everywhere, coast to coast, podcasts, TV shows, you've written books, you've been at seminars, you've been educating the public on this research and very important piece of historical information that seems to be trying to be just quieted. It's trying to be hushed down, like, no, don't pay attention to this. This is not, you know, they're not real, they're not here, but you got, you know, so many years, decades of research proving otherwise, that ever since we started dropping bombs from planes, they've been like, what are you guys up to? And it's very concerning because the national security or the global security is such that, you know, something like that is a threat to us. It might not be intentional, but to us seems like a threat. So maybe explain how you got involved in looking into the history of this and your passion in it, because you wrote 4 or 5 books on it. So obviously you're passionate about it. So let's delve into your career here and see what you came up with.
Okay, Jason. I mean, I've been interested in UFOs probably 45 years now. So go back to maybe even a bit longer, maybe get on for 50 years. So I think I was about 8 or 9 years old. My mother bought me a book, which she thought was another of these science fiction novels I was reading back then, Isaac Asimov titles, that nice spaceships on the front. And she bought me a book, similar thing, except it wasn't. It was a book on UFOs, had a picture of flying saucer on the front. Being a sponge back then, you know, anything that took my fancy, anything that really caught my interest, I would read it. I'd read it to death, cover to cover. I would, I would look for something else similar. And that's how I got into UFOs, just by reading all the books in the library. And that was just at a small library in the suburbs of a northern city, Newcastle in northern England, and then going to the major city library and digging out each of the books in the shelf of UFO books they had there as well. So by about maybe a year or so after I'd got interested in it, I'd read everything pretty much. I was quite a quick reader. I'd read everything that the city had for the public on UFOs. But of course, this was pre-internet days. I was a fairly young boy. There wasn't the kind of, and I was quite naive as well back then, and I wasn't very sure of myself. So it was difficult to try and get involved in groups or write to magazines to sign up for the newsletters that were around back then, say Flying Saucer Review, etc. And never mind what was happening on your side of the world, all the newsletters across there, which I had no idea about, apart from being little footnotes sometimes in the back of some of these UFO books. But these were, it was almost like a foreign language. So there was a lot going on, but I was just privy to a really small part of it, just this subset of books. Of course, as you get older, you start reading magazines, you see a lot more. And of course, when the internet started as well, everything just exploded because you had this access to a hell of a lot of stuff. And I'm going back to the 90s here. So this was a dial-up connection. Rather than having forums and blog posts and podcasts, you had what they called bulletin boards, Usenet, yeah. That kind of stuff. And it was like, these mailing lists. Yeah,
Old school. Yeah.
Old school, yeah. So it was like, kind of chains of emails that people would... And I was on the UFO groups as well, Twitter, and on Facebook. The conversations that people have, the kind of, you'll have the bunkers on one side, the true believers on the other side, and people in the middle as well that are doing stuff. So who are just trying to work out what's actually happening. They haven't got a dog in either fight, kind of thing. And it was the same back then. So you had patients, you just didn't have the information we have now. And of course, that changed in December 2017 with the release of those three videos that came out with the help of Lou Elizondo, Chris Mellon, et cetera, et cetera. And that changed everything as far as I was concerned, because it brought some credible information to the public and things that not necessarily couldn't be refuted, but certainly you couldn't ignore. And we then had people who were intimately involved in programs which could be documented. There's obviously information come out since to say that yes, Lou was part of the program, et cetera, et cetera. And these people have never gone away. They're not just people who are coming out of the woodwork saying, "Oh, I did this, or I saw this," and then disappearing again. They are people who will stay with us. They're telling us things as much as they can without going to jail and all the rest of it. And they come up with some fairly credible information. All we need next now is just more evidence to back up what they're saying. And that's the stumbling block at the moment. But we've got everything else going on at the moment. So it's been a bit of a journey these last sort of 45, 50 years, from things that I would never have expected in my lifetime to see. All the things that are happening now, all the videos which are coming out, like them, loathe them, sit in the middle, whatever, wherever you are on that spectrum. It's a hell of a lot more than we've had in the past. So yeah, it's wonderful. It's bizarre. It's frightening. You name it. But it's brilliant. I'm pleased I'm still alive. At this point in history, I'm sure it can only get better. But I never thought I'd be here. For sort of 40, 50 years ago.
Man, what a story! It's so nice to see people in the UAP subject feel delighted at where they are now. There's kind of a lot of ire and
it's almost vindication as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice for us. We came after 2017, but people like yourself, Graham, have been, you've been taking the punches, and there were Mike Tyson punches, let's face it, during those years. So for you to do what you did and stick to it, I mean, you're a pioneer in what is happening right now. So yeah, take pride in that. And I encourage anybody that's doing that, even the new dogs in the fight, like, take pride in what you do. You're on definitely the right side of history, right?
You've got to be positive, because, years ago, with all the kind of knocks that you were getting, the tinfoil helmet jibes and all the rest of it, and the fact that the media just didn't want to know in the subject, and you got ridicule from everybody that you spoke to or tried to speak to about the subject. So you got the point where you just kept quiet, apart from the people who you knew were interested in it. But nowadays, it seems that everybody, if they know that you're interested in this subject, they want to ask you questions. Even strangers or people that you meet or people that you've known, and the subject comes up and they ask in your opinion, which people have never done before. So that's absolutely brilliant. And it just shows how much it's permeating just much more widespread in the population at large, which we've never had that before. People have been aware of the subject, don't get me wrong, but they've never had as much interest, even outsiders as they have now. And you can see that in the media as well. And people are just, definitely wanting more information, but more credible information. Not the sort of stuff we used to get, the alien autopsy videos and all this stuff that people seem to be making just to try. The stuff that you can tell, which is either manufactured to try and get money or it's just there just to, as an audience pleaser. We need some proper credible information with stuff that can be backed up, corroborated. And you go from there rather than just this kind of this airy fairy flim flam kind of stuff that we've had in the past.
So you're research started, I mean, you sort of had a conjoint interest in like aviation in general, right? That's kind of also part of it and informed the angle that you took. So you've
Aviation,
got.
war, Second World War, German secret weapons, and UFOs, and everything just came together with the Foo Fighters because it's all
Sure.
linked. All that stuff is linked together.
Yeah. So tell us the story. Tell us the Foo Fighter story. Like all I know is that during the war, there were reports of these luminous orbs that would sort of follow around fighter planes, and that both sides suspected it was the property of the other. And then after the war, we sort of realized that it didn't belong to any of us, and that was the end of it. But there's a lot of conflict. There's also a lot of I was listening to a podcast called High Strange. I just finished it up. It's 8 parts. It's pretty good, but the guys are all new to the sort of UAP topic. And at one point, they conflate UAP. I mean, not UAP. They conflate Foo Fighters and just sort of the 1950s, 60s conception of a UFO. The sort of like saucer, silver saucer thing. But those weren't exactly the same, right? You, like Foo Fighters had a definite like physical appearance, and they were unique in some way. Tell us about that history.
So basically, what you've encapsulated there in terms of the description is pretty much what everybody, if you've been asked, say, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and even halfway through the 1990s to describe what the Foo Fighters were, that's what they would probably would have said. And if you'd pinned them down to say, look, can you give me some cases? Chances are they would have come up with about half a dozen. And they were from the same unit, the 415th Knife Fighter Squadron, which were based in eastern France before around about this, November, December 1944 and into 1945. And yes, they were experiencing these red balls of light, and some of them were different colors, but they were mostly red. And sometimes they would see them at a distance, sometimes they would see them near the aircraft, and occasionally they would follow the airplanes as well at night. On the various missions they were on between behind enemy lines, and this is kind of like over eastern France, eastern Belgium, west and Germany, sort of west of the Rhine area. So that gives you an air, kind of area where the location is. And when they did follow the airplanes, the pilots naturally would put the aircraft into evasive maneuvers to try and shake off what they thought were German aircraft on their tail. But they found that they couldn't shake them, and that nothing they did seemed to shake them, just sit there until they flew off of their own volition. Sometimes it was more than one, sometimes there were numerous of these things were seen. But it turns out when you look in the records of some of the RAF bomber squadrons, say over the Balkans, so Romania, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, that kind of area, in earlier in 1944, so I'm going back to maybe sort of March, April time, they started seeing these things as well. So this is much earlier than when the Foo Fighter, as the name, when that was coined, which was at the end of November 44, that actually just applies to what the American sightings were, because that's the name they give them. But these things, whatever they were, similar things have been seen much earlier, so 6 months earlier in the Balkans. But actually, you can go back even to RAF intelligence reports going back to 1942, and you'll see mention of things that could well be interpreted as the same, what they call rockets, and then later they call them jets in 44, because the terminology changes as what they think the enemy's technology changes. So you can see that you can see where the name, the names alter. They go from one thing to another. The Foo Fighter phenomenon itself, pilots and crews were exchanged between squadrons, and some of the ones who were based in northern Italy in 44 actually were transferred to Europe, to northern Europe, to help out for a little while over about Christmas, January 44, Christmas 44, January 45, when they went back to their units in Italy. They took stories of these things back with them, and sometimes even sightings. And of course, then when you look in the records of these two Italian squadrons or American squadrons actually operating in Italy, you'll see from February 45 the name Foo Fighter being used in their reports as well, because actually they were seeing them even before then. They were seeing them in 1944. RAF squadrons based in Italy were seeing them as early as night of spring 1943. So there's cases of aircraft being followed, all the way through 1943. So
So
you
how
can
does this
see that it's
deviate from our from the conception that we had? Like you're saying, this the standard story was that we started seeing them when, and when do we actually
November.
start seeing
Well,
them?
the Americans, the legend is that it was November 44 when it started, about the last week of November.
But you're saying we've seen them since 42?
Oh yeah, the reports are much earlier. You just have to know where to look to find this information. But of course, the legend has been built up, and I'll just give you a quick sort of rundown on this. If you read books in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s about Foo Fighters, the very limited information came from one source. It came from an American Legion article, which was published in December 45 by a Lieutenant Colonel Chamberlain, who was an aide to General Hap Arnold, who was the Commander-in-Chief of the US Army Air Forces at that time. And he was on effectively a fact-finding tour around European squadrons, the Night Fighter squadrons, and some other units as well, who were in Europe fighting against the Germans. And I suppose nowadays you would call that being embedded with the troops. He was trying to find out how things were working, whether the logistics were working, what morale was like, all this kind of stuff. But he was spent at least one night and maybe a few days with this particular squadron, the 415th. And of course, they started telling him, all this stuff about what they'd seen and how they were being followed by these lights, et cetera, et cetera. And he wrote it all down. Now, we're not entirely sure what he did with that information at the time and how far it went up the chain of command. But definitely afterwards, at the end of 45, this article was published in American Legion magazine, which is a forces newspaper, effectively. And it has six instances of things that happened to the 415th. There's a couple of reports from the Daylight Squadron, so P-47 Thunderbolt or Mustang squadrons that were operating over Germany at that time. And then there's a few references to a couple of cases which happened in the Pacific as well. So that's about as much information as the public had at that time, because some of those cases had also appeared in the newspapers in America at the beginning in 1945 when they were reporting on the Foo Fighters. So they were nothing new either. And that information was pretty much, with a few exceptions, all that ufologists had to go on for about the next 50 years.
And you
So that's
found
when you
more, though.
see.
What did
Well,
you?
to be fair, there was more out there. There was a few people that had come forward in the subsequent decades to say, look, I was flying a bomber or I was flying a fighter, et cetera, and we saw this, that, and the other. So you can find these stories, but they were never given the prominence that some of the other cases throughout those decades were given. It's almost like everybody just thought, oh, it's before 1947. It doesn't fit into the overall story that everything kicked off with Kenneth Arnold. So we'll just not talk about it, kind of thing. And people obviously had their eye on other stuff that was happening, much more recently in it, because, well, why wouldn't you? So by the end of the by midway through the 1990s, some of the American archives opened up so you could get access to these squadron records. And there was a few people did actually dig in, and they did get to find the original documents that showed those cases that Chamberlain had put in that article in 1945. But then they found others as well. So these were American reports. And then a couple of people in Britain, there was a guy called Andy Roberts and another guy called David Clark. They started doing the same in Britain. They put letters out in various aviation magazines in about the late 1990s, early 2000s, asking for former air crew to come forward with the stories. So there's a few more, quite a few more stories came out then. But the thing that people hadn't done was look through some of the squadron records. They hadn't gone through the mission reports. Now, I did that. And that's when I found the cases from the Balkans and some others as well. And I'm still finding them now because I'm actually doing a follow-up to this book, which I'm still in the early stages of. And I'm finding even more cases which have never been, ever been reported. Now, they're not categoric proof that UFOs existed, but they just don't fit what was happening back in World War II. The descriptions of some of these things are, quite frankly, they just didn't exist then, but clearly they did because these things are being reported. And to make it even worse in terms of that narrative falling apart about everything starting in 47, some of these cases are from 1940. And that's even before you guys got in the war, So it starts very early.
So
And
there.
they're talking about, well, just one last thing. They're talking about aircraft with searchlights. And the Germans never used that kind of equipment. What were they saying? And of course, a lot of the reports say they're not sure what they're looking at. They can just see lights. So from that, they're assuming that these are aircraft with searchlights or aircraft with headlights and all this kind of stuff, following their bombers, sometimes for up to 250 miles. And none of this makes any sense whatsoever, but it's in the official intelligence reports. And I'm finding month after month when I'm reading these things through the 1940, 1941, 1942, that they just don't know what they're looking at.
So, I was thinking about this, it's always related to war. Every time that we're at war, there's a spell or a wave of these Foo Fighters. They follow aircrafts that carry certain ammunitions. I mean, it's fair to say the military doesn't, or the deep state doesn't want to tell anybody about this because they're fighting them, because it's a threat to them. Like every time they go anywhere, these things are there. The Navy is not exempt from that. They're being followed underneath the water, above the water. It's not just scanning the weaponry, but maybe even our intentions. Like we know these entities are known to be able to read minds, but if they find out what our intentions are with the weaponry in just a quick scan over, this is important. There's a connection between our warmongering amongst ourselves and their interest in it. And it seems like they monitor the big weapons that are going to cause more damage, like the nuclear, that
Definitely.
they got physical. I mean, they were, Foo Fighters before the crash, let's say at Roswell. After that, they became saucers. When, what's his face, Kenneth Arnold mentioned they were almost like skipping like saucers. They weren't shaped like saucers. They had a weird shape,
No.
but they said it was. But after that, it seemed like physically they were manifesting in saucer shapes, whereas before we didn't have that. And now today we have weird phenomenons. It's not so much saucer anymore. Do you have a theory as to why they keep changing to our appearance?
I'm not sure they keep changing, Jason. I think there is a kind of you'll see a majority reports of a certain type or other, but there's such difference in the shape, sizes, colors, and the way these things act and react that you can't really pin them down to one particular type and say, oh, look, we're seeing this sort of thing here and that sort of thing then. Because when we were seeing saucer shape kind of objects, we were also seeing things that were called cigar-shaped objects. Now, cigar shape, torpedoes, Tic Tacs. Torpedoes, aerial torpedoes were reported in World War II. They're in the intelligence files again of these things that the class, well, they're called rockets sometimes, but they actually are described as being torpedoes, sometimes with jets of flame coming out the back of them. Now, you would think that might be a missile, but where they're seen and when they're seen rules out any kind of German technology. So the things that we see, I mean, we're talking about this just before we brought, you started the broadcast, is that things come around, it's like kind of circular. So things that we saw in the past start to, you see them again, but they might be just called something slightly different, but that doesn't mean to say they haven't been seen in the past, and chances are we'll see them again in the future. So the things that were that Kenneth Arnold saw, which were described as actually heel shaped to start with, I know a lot of people have said, oh, they look like a flying wing, but that was much later. The story seemed to change into what they looked like, or what he described them to be, because the original letter that he sends to Air Force investigators to say, this is what I saw, just days after the event as well, he draws them at the end of the letter, and it looks like the heel of a shoe.
Yeah, sort of
This is really
U-shaped
what,
with a crescent.
yeah, with a with a
Yeah.
yeah with a little mark there. So
Like a boomerang almost, rounded boomerang.
well, no, it's not actually. No, it's not. You can imagine, like, if you take the heel off your shoe and look at it from above,
Okay.
that's what it looks like. So it's got that indentation in it,
Oh,
like that,
okay.
rather than being like a kind of crescent.
Okay.
Because when you're seeing the popular pictures of Arnold holding up that artwork, it's like a crescent. It's like a flying wing aircraft, like the Horton flying wing from World War II. But that's not what he originally said he saw. So sometimes the names change in the telling. So so you've got to be careful with how things are portrayed, because sometimes what people say, oh well, that's that because it because he saw that, that's what he must be seeing. Well, actually no, if you go back to the original documentation, that's not what he said he saw.
Like the
So you
telephone
have to
game, right?
you
Remember
have to
that
trace
game?
things. Or Chinese whispers. You have to trace everything back to its source to find out what the real sort of information was.
So is
And
there one
actually,
typology for for Foo Fighters? Was there
no,
one
there
sort of
wasn't.
consistent appearance? What are the kinds of things that are seen?
Well,
I
I mean,
know
in
them as
terms of,
lights, that's it.
So if you're talking about generally everything that was seen in World War II, there's all shapes and sizes. But the Foo Fighters themselves, this subset of things that were seen in World War II, were just lights. They weren't attached to airplanes. even though the intelligence experts higher up the chain of command, when this was reported to, they came back to the part to the intelligence officers in the squadron and said, "Well, which part of the aircraft are these lights attached to?" Because they had no, no kind of idea about what was going on, and they had no comprehension even about what was happening. So there was a failure to try and connect the dots. No, the pilot is seeing lights. That's all they're seeing. The lights were different colors. They acted in various different ways, sometimes following the aircraft, sometimes not. But other things were seen in World War II. So these things that looked like rockets that were zigzagging around the sky, they were seen as well, behaving un-rocket-like, un-flying bomb-like. There were other things that there was a battle over near Leningrad in February 1943, the Battle of Krasny Bor, and there's some Spanish volunteers fighting on the side of the Germans, but they're in a Spanish infantry division. It's called the 250th Infantry Division, or the Blue Division, it was called, and they are there in this battle, and a group of these soldiers look up above the battlefield and above these Russian and German aircraft, which are also slugging it out above them. And there's this thing looking like an upturned bathtub sitting up there watching everybody. So that's another story. So there's
That's
another shape.
concerning. Yeah.
There's an RAF bomber crew flying over the northern over the Italian Alps on the way to bomb an engine factory in Turin in November 1942. And from this Lancaster bomber, the crew see this what they estimate to be 200 or 300 foot long torpedo shaped object, and then they see it again. A little bit later in the mission, flying down a mountain valley in between the peaks of the mountains. So there's another shape entirely. Civilian, there's a civilian on the ground in, I think it's Czechoslovakia in 1944. He reports seeing a kind of zeppelin-shaped object. There was no zeppelins around then, certainly not in, that part of Europe. So there's like a similarity again. So you can see the same sort of things being reported. But yeah, there's wingless craft are mentioned in various reports. There's an Army Air Force bomber on an anti-submarine patrol over the Bay of Biscay, so that's off Spain, off France, that kind of bit of sea off those two countries, just south of Britain, and it's on an anti-submarine patrol in November 42 again, and this what they describe as a wingless craft come up behind the aircraft. It sits with them for 10, 15 minutes, does a 180 degree turn, and flies away again. Photographs were supposed to be taken of that object by one of the crewmen, but those have never surfaced.
So
So,
they don't just have unique forms, their behavior is also clearly
intelligent,
troubling.
all different.
And yeah, but there's like hovering behavior, it sounds like you're saying, and
Fast moving, hovering, or you name it almost. It's imagine you imagine everything that you've seen, in the years after World War II. It's almost encapsulated in World War II. And we're basically just scratching the surface of the reports, because there are still lots of, well, RAF squadron documents I still haven't gone through yet, because I'm only touching the surface of them. And we don't I have no idea what other intelligence documents there might well be. It's just a question of trying to find them and maybe stumbling across them. And I'm sure there's a heck of a lot of stuff that the American, the Army Air Force had back then as well, which people still haven't managed to get access to for one reason or another. Not necessarily because it's secret, just because you haven't put the right search parameters in, let's say.
sure.
Because a lot of things don't, you can't just say UFO report World War II, because obviously that terminology wasn't used back then. So,
Sure,
and they
yeah.
didn't think that's what they were anyway, because that hadn't entered the lexicon. It hadn't entered popular thinking. So they're not classed as that. But you have to be creative. You have to look for intelligence reports that look at flak explosions, anti-aircraft shell explosions, that kind of stuff. That's how you get into these kind of reports, because that's actually where they're reported. When they did analysis of how effective anti-aircraft guns were, you often see reports of strange flying things in those reports, especially from some of the army officers who flew in the bombers over on raids over Germany, because they would do detailed reports of everything they saw in the mission. And those, are sometimes little gold mines of details. So yeah, it's knowing where to look. And of course, if you're a UFO researcher who has a general knowledge of maybe everything, but not a specialized knowledge of World War II, then you might not necessarily have the wherewithal to be able to, dig into these things. That's not a criticism. It's just it's just stating a fact. Whereas somebody who has a bit more idea of how these things work might be able to find them a bit better. But of course, that's just going from my experience as an aviation historian as well. I'll leave it to these guys, as some of the people who went before me, because they're much better at other things in ufology than I'll ever be. So, we all have our strengths and weaknesses.
So,
I love your cat, by the way.
what's that? Yes.
Oh,
I keep
yeah.
watching his cats go to and fro. I'm like, man, I hope they pick a fight. That'd be awesome to see
Oh, are
in the
they?
background.
I don't
No,
have my
no.
own screen on.
I can
But
only see
yeah,
one
there's
of
two now. There's there there
them.
was only one before, but now there's two, so she must have snuck up here.
Love it.
They're very sneaky.
So, one question, Graham, is that we've been firing and trying to take these things down from the
Oh, yeah.
start. And David Grush, I mean, in Congress, they asked him, has there ever been consequences or damages to humans related to these things? And he's like, oh yeah, right. My guess is that there's a lot, probably more military incidences with these crafts. I mean, now we are hearing from Grush that we came up with some sort of EMP on our jets to bring these things down. They brought three of them down recently here in North America. I think it was last year. Of course, no news on that. They didn't do a recover or anything. They're good. They're good. They just flew away, which is full of shit. But they're shooting these things down. My concern is somebody who's not elected, it was never voted in. People are making decisions on our behalf to shoot at something we don't understand, picking a fight with something that is clearly more advanced than we are. What are your thoughts on that? Because it's not just the United States. I mean, every country is in it for themselves. China's shooting on them, Russia shooting on them. All the major powers are trying to get, so what are your
Oh yeah.
thoughts on that? Like, what are the consequences of our technology increasing and then picking a fight with something that we shouldn't really be picking a fight with?
Well, you go back to the conquistadors. They come with advanced weaponry, don't they? And they're fighting people who have effectively spears and bows and arrows. And if
Yeah.
you're going to fight a knight with armor, and all the rest of it with a bow and arrow, then you're probably going to come off worst. So yeah, there's that. I guess the Air Force or air forces around the world will have specific rules of engagement as to how they deal with things that they don't understand. And I guess also it depends on what kind of a threat that they're assessed to pose as to whether or not they are brought down. But I'm just going to go back to World War II for a second here, Jason, if you don't mind.
After you're a master
Things
in
were
it, of course. Yeah.
things were fired on back then. Now, obviously, we don't know whether aircraft were blown up, because if the pilots were killed, the crews were killed, then we'll never hear from them. But we do know of, or at least we are aware of, certain incidents that happened when there doesn't appear to be any kind of comeback whatsoever. So March 1942, a Polish crewed Wellington bomber threw a one squadron Royal Air Force flying back from a mission on Essen in the Ruhr in Germany, and they're flying over Holland. And from behind the aircraft comes this amber disc. The tail gunner of the aircraft shouts over the intercom to the pilot, "We've got something coming behind us." The pilot said, "Well, obviously, everybody thinks it's a night fighter, so a German night fighter going to shoot them down." So the pilot says, "Open fire on it when it gets close enough." So, of course, it comes close into range, and the tail gunner opens fire with his rear gun turret, which has four 0.303-inch machine guns. And every 10th round is a tracer round, so it's an illuminated round rather than a bullet, and it
Okay.
shows you where the bullets are going at night.
That's
These
clever.
bullets
Yeah.
go, yeah, that's how they used to do things back then. They were called tracer rounds. I think they're still, I'm sure they still use those kind of thing
Yeah, we still use
nowadays.
tracer rounds sometimes.
Yeah, I'm sure they do,
Well,
yeah.
actually, your
Anyway.
background, there's some firing in the background
Yeah,
from
well,
the plane. There's some
this is
red
the cover
stuff.
of the book. This is the cover of the UFO of the Foo Fighters
Yeah.
book that I wrote, and it actually depicts this incident. So these bullets are going into this disc, and nothing happens. It's not like the whatever object it is, whether it's an airplane or whatever, it doesn't fall away on fire. It doesn't explode. It doesn't try to evade. It just almost absorbs these bullets. They go in and don't come out the other end, and nothing happens to the object. It just sits there and takes it. After how many rounds have been fired at this thing, the disc then flies round to the wingtip of the airplane and sits off the wingtip. All the time that the gun turret's tracking round, and firing at this thing, and it gets to the point where it's sitting far enough off the wingtip that actually the nose gun turret can also, he can turn his turret sufficiently far enough backwards that he can fire at this thing as well. So the person in the gun turret, and both gun turrets, they're firing at this object to no avail whatsoever. But then, to add insult to injury, it flies round to the front of the aircraft and sits at a certain distance in front of the nose, and they're both flying through over Holland at about maybe 200 miles an hour or so. And this thing's just, keeping station, a certain distance in front of the airplane. And the nose gunner, again, he's turned his turret back, to point ahead, and he's firing this thing, and nothing's happening. And after a little while, it just shoots off at 45 degrees up into the heavens and disappears.
They're jerks.
They get back to the on the ground at the base, and after every mission, there's always a debrief. Intelligence officer would come and ask them what was happening. And they tell the story. And the first thing he says was, have you been drinking? But there's a crew in the kind of group of aircraft behind them. They say they saw it too. So there is kind of corroboration of a sort, but it's not documented anywhere. It was told to a researcher, the story, in about 1962 or so. So it's quite an old story, but one that's never really been given any kind of prominence whatsoever.
Well, even the Battle of Los Angeles, weren't we firing at these things for 6 or 8 hours with no avail?
1,400 shells fired at that thing, and nothing happened.
Yeah, you can't dismiss that. That's pretty bad. Like anything, a flock of seagulls would have come down with the artillery shells we were sending up there.
A balloon on an airplane would have. And the kind of the response, the excuses that you get for that thing are where it was war nerves, or it was a Japanese airplane, or it was a balloon that escaped. Any of those things, a balloon or a Japanese aircraft, even an American aircraft, would have been filled so full of holes that it would have come down. But this thing not only flew past all the gun sites, it then turned around and went back up again. So, to add insult to injury, and they were still trying to shoot at it, and nothing happened.
For hours. This is legit, right? Like, there's no in between. God, yeah, that's crazy.
So it was tracked on radar as well. So,
do you have a theory about what these things are? I mean, are you an ETH, extraterrestrial hypothesis, or do you?
I'm going to disappoint you here, because I don't really have any hard and fast opinions on what they are. I'd leave that to people, especially readers, to work it out for themselves, because I don't want to actually put ideas in their head. I'd rather them read what I the kind of information as I find it, and put it to them and say, well, look, what do you think these things are? Do you think after all this information there is something to this, or are you not sure, or do you still think there's it's just a lot of rubbish? Because really, I've over the years and going back several decades, I'd see these books that are some of the books I'd read, not all of them, the ones which weren't as good, they would try and shoehorn stuff into a book to make it fit a narrative. And anything that was inconvenient, they would leave out. And then they would put other stuff in. Or you would get these kind of leaps of logic where you'd think, well, how do you get to there from where you've just started from? And even at a young age, I would look at some of these things where they were saying, blah, blah, and I would just, well, how do you get there from here? And some of it just didn't make any sense whatsoever. And I vowed if I ever got the position, this is going back a long time, but I thought back then, if I ever get the point where I can write a book, I would never do this. I would just put the information down as I found it and let the reader decide. I think it's much better that way, because really, I know we've all got opinions. Mine's no better than anybody else's. People might call me an expert on the Foo Fighters, but actually, it's just that I've found out more stuff than certain other people have. That doesn't make me an expert on something. Actually, I still don't understand. It just makes me a little bit more knowledgeable than certain other people. But that's nowhere in any shape or form being an expert, I'm afraid.
I don't know. I mean, I'm supposedly an expert on something because I have a PhD, but I don't feel any more like an expert than you're describing yourself. I mean, I know more about, I've put some time into something and I'm probably smart, but I don't think it's out of the capacity of other people to do the same. I've just put that work in, and it sounds like you've done the same thing. You've got a much more informed opinion, and you certainly don't have exhaustive knowledge of the thing. There's almost nothing that you can really have exhaustive knowledge about. The world's just too complex. But I really appreciate the work that you've done. I think you are an expert. You just never feel like one.
I think, Michael, what I've had been able to do, however, is rule out certain things. Because if you do an internet search for Foo Fighters, you'll see people who are trying to tell you until they're blue in the face that, these were just German secret weapons, or that the Germans were inventing flying saucers, because there's a standard opinion that thinks that's the case. But actually, when you go into these stories and you do, dive into them and you try and trace them back to where they started from, you will find that they don't amount to very much. And part of the Foo Fighters book, because yes, okay, I use the word Foo Fighters, but it wasn't about everything that happened in World War II. And the last kind of third of the book basically tries to explode the myth that the Germans invented flying saucers, or they had some weird and wonderful apparatus that could have been mistaken for Foo Fighters, because that's another strand of gobbledygook that's out there. There's a lot of people actually point to a book that was written by an Italian guy in the late 60s, who tried to basically tell everybody that there was those two particular types of German secret weapon that could have accounted for all these things. And again, you go into all of it and it's all pure nonsense, but it's a long-lasting nonsense, and it's persisted and it's built upon, and then people basically just perceive it as fact because they see it written down places, or they see it on the internet, so therefore it must be true. And you see it regurgitated in all manner of places. You'll see it on documentaries, you'll see it in books, you'll see it on TV, everywhere. In the end up playing whack-a-mole with this kind of thing, because as soon as you've sort of argued one, then there's another one pops out, and you see it on Facebook as well, that every so often somebody pops up and goes, "Hey guys, has anybody seen this? This is really
Because you
interesting."
have to,
No, we'll see you
yeah,
in a week
it's
or
been
so.
around for so there's it has a sort of initial plausibility though, because during the war we are in a sort of race of technological sophistication trying to pursue jet propulsion and other things and get those things right. So there are these anxieties, and Germany probably was in certain very important respects more technologically sophisticated than at least the American army was at least at the beginning of the war. But so the anxiety about that sort of gives an initial ground to the speculation that, well, they did have secret weapons, and so maybe that must be it. Can you give us a quick rundown of why it's all just nonsense? I mean, people probably read about things like the Glocke or the Bell, which is some code name for a secret German something or other that we the Americans evidently got hold of. If you read I think Hunt for Zero Point, Nick Pope tells this story. But
Nick Cook,
there's
yeah.
all this mystery around those things. How do you sort the gobbledygook from the truth?
Well, they're fairly seductive kind of like stories, and I first came across the stuff about the Glocke in Nick Cook's book Hint for Zero Point, as you mentioned, and it was also a documentary which was shown on the TV in here in Britain in probably the late 90s, early 2000s. I can't remember exactly when now. But in terms of German flying saucers, I remember reading about those in about 1982, so that's going back a fair while, in a book about German secret weapons, just about the airplanes that they were building, and seeing this stuff and thinking, okay, well, that's new, I've never heard about that before, and then finding nothing else about it. But it turns out that that particular side of things, that the flying discs myth, it all originated from a whole load of people who came out of the woodwork in the early 1950s saying, "I was a designer, I built these things, I tested these things," all this kind of stuff. And there was newspaper reports in various German and Italian newspapers and magazines at about this time, so 50, 51, 52, etc., saying all these kind of stuff, but none of them could be backed up. There's never been a shred of evidence to suggest that any of these people were in the positions they were. One even said he was a test pilot for Henkel, a German aircraft manufacturer, but there's no evidence to suggest that he ever was. There's another guy who said he worked on the V2 rocket program, but then some of the other stuff he comes out with is so outlandish that it can't be possibly true. He talks about flying out of Breslau, which was a city surrounded by the Russians in 1945, where he was supposed to be working on one of these flying saucers, and then he's flown out of the city in a measurement comet, the rocket-propelled interceptor that the Germans flew. Well, it was a single-seater. They did have a twin seat, but it didn't have an engine in it. It was a glider. So, there's all this kind of stuff that it couldn't have possibly flown this airplane out of there. It's just preposterous. And also, this particular type of aircraft was only operated in one part of Germany with specialized fuels, a specialized support structure, and all the rest of it. There's no way they could have had these other aircraft somewhere else to fly them. So, none of this story makes sense. And then you dive into the other aspects of the disc myth, and you can see similar inconsistencies and outright lies. And then there's also a CIA document from 1954, which is just a translation of a foreign language newspaper, which says, I think it's from a South African newspaper, funny enough, in Afrikaans, that says, that mentions about a German guy called George Klein, who says he was part of the secret weapons test, kind of over overarching the people who looked after secret weapons programs. He was kind of a, he was a, an administrator rather than an engineer, and that he was privy to a test flight of one of these discs in February 45. Now, that's so people say, oh, well, it must be real because it's a CIA document. Well, no, it's a translation of a foreign newspaper. That doesn't make you sure it's real. You know, it's just reporting on something that somebody else reported. But this is how people latch on to these things. And then it's sort of the story evolves, and it's your Chinese whispers. You know, it changes in the telling, and then it becomes fact down the line. And it's very, very hard to dismiss. But nevertheless, when you trace things back to their source, you'll find there isn't much truth in them at the end of the day. And then,
sorry to cut you off. Go ahead.
Go on. It's just that they claim that they were designing or building or both these flying discs.
What did they claim propelled these things? How did they? I mean, like,
well, this is where it all gets a bit vague. This is where it gets very vague about what the power system is. There's sometimes you get cutaway drawings, but none of it makes any sense. And nobody has been able to replicate this kind of stuff. Because quite frankly, if there'd been engineers in the 50s who were building this kind of stuff, we'd be flying around in them now. You know, we wouldn't need fossil fuels. We wouldn't be having a climate crisis. We would be zipping around in one of these things that were built then. And if so, why haven't they won the war if they had these wonderful, sure, you know,
I have a theory, gentlemen.
That's funny.
Yeah, I got a theory, gentlemen, and I just need to set it up. And I might be out there, but I just need your input.
Go for it.
We're part of the primate family, and one of the, I wouldn't say qualities, but one of the biggest factors in primates is the violence. Not only that we cause to each other amongst primates, you know, chimpanzees do the same thing as us. They'll invade other territories and kill the other chimpanzees to gain access to that territory. Even cannibalism, I'm having a hard time with my words, is practiced amongst chimpanzees when they take over another territory as a form of frightening the other chimpanzees. I always thought about this in the sense of, what if from the get-go, we are an experiment, but we're more of a biological weapon because of our aggression. But technology in our hands is very threatening to another civilization that's more peaceful. The advancement that we get is maybe just trying to progress us to a faster level to be, you know, why is it that they're so fascinating with our weaponry, our wars? Is it that they're keeping updates on our progress, or are they interested in how we destroy each other? There's an interest there, and we have to start thinking about, what is that interest? Is it for them? Are they worried? I don't think they're worried about themselves. I think they'll be just fine. But there's a reason why they're interested in us. It's either because they're worried or because we're of purpose to them. And this is what I constantly think about in our wars, because they're always close to weapons that are going to cause death, and people who are intent on causing death. That's their mission. They come up close and they check it out.
And so maybe that's what's interesting about us, is our violent sort of ingenuity or something.
Absolutely. And we fire on them. Nothing happens. They're like, oh, they're cute. They're not quite there yet, but that's cute. It's like a toddler having a tantrum, right? But that it's a theory we have to look at. It's a different perspective. Instead of saying that they're a threat to us, maybe we're a threat to others and we're service to them. Like, we have to start thinking outside the boundaries of conventional homo sapien thinking. And I just want to throw it out there to see if that had any validity amongst men like yourselves.
I think wars tend to bring out the best and the worst of people. So you get, you know, huge, courageous people, you get acts of valor, you'll get the worst, you know, depravities, and everything in between. But yeah, it's also, it's a time of extremes. You know, everybody, the whole range of emotions are shown. It's not a normal situation for people to be
innovation
in
as actually, well, though, Graham.
Well, exactly. I was coming to that. Yeah. So people are, you know, are very, very kind of motivated to improve themselves, to improve what they do, you know, how they do things, just general things, never mind weapons. But I mean, there's another argument as well. There's a strand that thinks that, whatever these things are, they might just be time travelers from the future. They might be us from the future looking back. And my kind of view on that would be, if that is true, and that's a big if, because we people like myself have a kind of this morbid fascination with like World War II, for instance. If there was one period of history where if I had a time machine, I could go and have a look without any kind of penalty or fear or of being changing the future or whatever, this kind of stuff, and I could look at, it would be World War II. And I'd probably look at the Eastern Front in World War II because it's something I've always been interested in as well. So, if I could sit in a bubble and watch a battlefield from, from 10,000 feet or whatever, like a kind of God's eye view of what was going on, sure, I would take that opportunity. So I can imagine if there was something like an upturned bathtub against, above the Battle of Krasny Bor, and here's some future historian, some future version of me with a high-tech notebook and pen going, oh yeah, I can see what's going on here. That would be a fantastic opportunity. People would take that. They would go on cruises. So they could go and watch, they could watch the Battle of Britain, or they
No,
could
God.
watch the Battle of Midway or Pearl Harbor or
Napoleon,
something in real time. Yeah, Napoleon, exactly, anything like that, or the Korean War, or what we would do, you and I were doing in Iraq kind of thing, our countries were doing in Iraq. All this kind of stuff, you can imagine the opportunities that people in the future might take to do it. Now, I'm not saying that's correct and that's what I think, but it's one possibility. But equally, an outside agency of some description sees, the monkeys are throwing rocks at each other again. Maybe they don't do that. Maybe they settle differences amicably, a different way. And maybe we are the only species in the world, in the universe, who settle our differences by throwing rocks at each other. So maybe that's why we're so
It's
special
worked
in
so
terms
well
of,
so far, right?
well,
It's
yeah.
worked
And maybe
like,
that's why they watch us very closely, because that's how we settle differences. We do that, so who knows?
I think that
Michael.
well, my thought is that I have several thoughts. One is that I'm part of me is skeptical about whether UAP activity actually increases during war times, or if we are just engaging in the activity that allows us to encounter it more often, right? I mean, we have way more planes in the sky during wartime, way more, visual observers going on. We're also doing much more disturbing, I'm like geologically disturbing things. We're dropping bombs and stuff. So, if you had a bunch of sensors, autonomous like flying sensors anywhere on Earth, and you just started randomly carpeting it with bombs, you'd see a rise in activity because they have to evade or whatever. So I don't know. We don't have any good experimental evidence of saying, well, let's just put a bunch of people in planes the way we would if we were in war and see if we get the same number of encounters or whatever. So I'm
And
kind of agnostic about that.
they're not just trained observers either. They're highly motivated to watch out for things which are out of the ordinary. In World War II, you had, tens of thousands of trained airmen. So whether they were gunners, navigators, pilots, you name it. So you had, all the night bomber crews that were flying from Britain over Germany. You had the American daylight raids. That were flying from Britain as well. Then you have all the crews in the Pacific War, the ones in the Mediterranean, the flying North Africa, all these places. They're looking out for anything that might be a threat. Whether it's an anti-aircraft gun explosion, whether it's a potential, well, there were aircraft coming up to attack them, or anything else that might be out of the ordinary, and they report it. It's not just to keep it to themselves and think, oh, I'm not going to tell anybody. It's reported when they get back to base. It's all catalogued. It's filed. If it's interesting enough, it goes further and it becomes a subject of intelligence reports further up the chain of command. And they analyze it to death, basically, to make sure it's not the beginning of some potential threat, because
Which is
that's what they
totally different
did.
from how it's done today. I mean, like today you have all these incentives to not report something if you see it because, there might be shame or
Stigma.
you might be
Yeah.
taken off flight status or something. But there was like public propaganda from our government saying, if you see anything strange, tell the government because we need everybody to be on the lookout. This actually becomes Carl Jung's sort of disingenuous explanation for the increase in like civilian UFO observations after the war is that people are so traumatized by looking up and wondering if there's going to be a bomber above them that they start, just kind of seeing things out of the
Not
corner of their
seeing
eye. We later find out in 2009, after Carl Jung's Red Book was published, that he wasn't a naturalist who believed that there were no strange things in the sky. I mean, he was secretly a sorcerer who believed in magic and all sorts of stuff. But yeah, so I don't know if there's an increased interest in war, but it would make sense if there were. But I also don't know. There's some part of me that wonders if our modes of behavior or our modes of observation influence the form that these phenomena take. I mean, I'm totally fascinated by the fact that during wartime, it's easy to perceive these things as aircraft. And during, Kenneth Arnold doesn't say that he sees aircraft. He eventually says that he thinks they were organic beings themselves. But it gets sort of mis it gets bungled in by a journalist and says that he saw a saucer, and then we see an explosion of genuine saucer observations. And I wonder if there's some sort of reciprocity or like circular cybernetic kind of influence going on there between the way we observe and what we expect to see and what actually manifests. But that's a totally speculative realm at that point.
It's strange, isn't it? Because people will see things again and again, and there's vast swathes of the human race apparently don't see them at all. And then other people will see the same shape or the same form, and then people see different ones as well. So is it a case of, it can manifest itself as different shapes, different times, or is it the same thing and just reveals itself in a different way? But then, of course, there are stories of things that change shape during the observation as well.
Sure,
There's
yeah.
a noted one from 1954 of a Labrador of a BOA crew, of an airliner crew, seeing a shape which was then, I think, written off as Mars, if I remember rightly, or something like that anyway. But it was and it wasn't just one shape. There was one big shape and a whole load of little ones on either side of it. But the main shape effectively changed the way it looked over the period of a, sort of several minute observation. And the pilots actually had the presence of mind to draw it, to draw the different types of shapes involved. So they have some record of, what it looked like, and it does radically change shape, which I don't believe a planet can do, at least not one I've seen anyway. But yeah, so there are stories of things
Seagulls.
that
It was
do.
seagulls.
It was
Yeah.
seagulls. Oh, right. Okay. Well, look at that. I mentioned
There's a great
seagulls.
case that this reminds me of. It's I don't know if it's MUFON or the French version of MUFON is called like OVNI, but I know that there was a family. I think they're in France because Jacques Vallée gives this photograph to Gary Nolan at some point, where there's this family in France and they're driving along on a road trip and they've got one of these cars that has like a complete glass roof on it, you can see
Panoramic roof,
completely
yeah.
through. Yeah. And I think there's like two teenagers in the back and like a mother and father in the front. And they notice that there's something above them that's following them. And they all describe it similarly as I think disc shaped and pretty large. And the kids start taking out their phone and snapping pictures of it. And then when they look at the pictures later, it looks completely different from what all of them uniformly described it as being. It was a disc, I think, and then the picture shows it as being something much smaller and larger and higher up, but having like seven spokes from a central small circle or something. So I think there are somebody could write a really good book on case studies where where descriptions vary in some radical way, but there's good evidence that all of the descriptions are at least corroborated, if not genuine.
Yeah, it's also strange how people expect to take really good pictures of a UFO with a mobile phone because they're not suited for that kind of thing. You try and take a picture of a high-flying aeroplane with a mobile phone, you're going to get nothing, of any substance, unless you've got a really good camera as
They're
well.
starting to. They're starting to. You could
They're
almost zoom
starting to,
on.
yeah, that's
Yeah.
true. But the ones, say, of the last 10 years, when you had a mobile phone camera, they're not going to do it. I mean, I've got an i14, but I still can't take a decent picture of a 747 going over at 30,000 feet kind of
No, you
thing
need a
with it. So,
telephoto lens to do that. I mean,
yeah,
we
you
don't
do. Yeah,
have.
that's right. Yeah. So you, whatever you have in your pocket at the time, you're not necessarily going to get a decent photograph. However, the pictures that you used to see back in the day, the ones that used to be in this in the UFO books back in the 70s and 80s, you'd be lucky if it was like a fuzzy black blob on a, on a, on a photograph.
Yeah.
And you just wonder about, you know, because photographs, cameras were, you know, reasonably decent back then in terms of taking pictures. So what was it that actually just made them this fuzzy blob? Was it that, you know, the exposure was wrong, the aperture was wrong, or was it that the whatever these things that we're trying to take pictures of, you know, rendered, you know, cameras, you know, make them, you know, impossible to take pictures of them properly? You know, did it actually just make them come out as blurs? It's really weird how there weren't any real definite shapes, and then when you did get a definite shape, turned out to be a hoax. You know, Adamski's pictures. You know, because I think it's been proven pretty much that, you know, it's a, it was like a kind of light housing that you could buy, like a lampshade, with a few baubles or light bulbs stuck underneath it.
Yeah.
Funny enough, just as a quick aside, once those pictures came out, you then got the German Hornibu supposed flying disc pictures coming out, or the drawings coming out, and they bear a very, very striking resemblance to Adamski's pictures.
I
Oh,
was never
interesting.
an Adamski fan. I know a lot of
Adamski or Billy
people.
Meyer, one of the two, anyway. It's the
Yeah.
one of these kind of like Joe, these saucer pictures that look too good to be true. So I'm pretty sure it's Adamski's actually. But this is you, so you see these things and you think, the sharper the, you know, the thing people think, well, the sharper the better for these pictures. But actually, it turns out that sometimes, you know, yeah, okay, they're just hoaxes, basically. And a lot of the stuff that you would see from back then that were really sharp, with a few exceptions, of course. I'm talking about the McMinnville pictures of
McMinnville,
1950. Yeah, the Paul Trent picture. That is clearly something anomalous because it's just never ever been worked out what the heck that was. And he just shot that from a camera that his wife got out of the house for him. It was just outside, above the farm, wasn't it? But it doesn't really give you much detail beyond this kind of little plain black, very low hat shape.
yeah. I would
You
say
know, it.
the most impressive one, Graham, of I think it was 1952, the flyover Washington. Those the crafts or whatever. Usually when you take a picture, it's like it seems large, and then you like you ever take a picture of the moon because it's so bright and you try to show somebody it's like a tiny little dot. It's like it doesn't do it justice. But you think about the 1950s and somebody captures these crafts and they look large. So you got to think they must have been really massive in person compared to what's so it you know, people say, why don't they land on the White House lawn? No, they did a flyby. You know, it's quite
Quite a
noticeable.
few flybys those nights.
Multiple times, yeah.
Yeah, multiple times.
Yeah,
So,
two weekends in July 1952 it happened.
but
So
see,
the
it's
Air
this
Force would
missing
know.
that. It's this missing that that bugs me. I say, well, nothing new's happened since. Okay, but it only needs to happen once. That's it. It doesn't need to happen again. The Phoenix Lights is like almost like a harbinger of other events that are going to take place. You know, it's at 1997. You got the Phoenix Lights. You know, 2017. We get the article comes out. You got John Ramirez says that 2027 is a big reveal. So I mean, it's coming. There's
It's coming,
momentum.
but I don't necessarily put too much sort of stock in people giving predictions for dates
True enough.
because
True
you
enough.
know we've been down that road with a lot of people. You know, the end of the world is nigh, and all, you know, all these kind of cults who
Drink
keep
Kool-Aid with
saying,
new
yeah,
Nike
all this kind of
shoes.
thing is going to happen, and it just and then they have to revise the date when the date arrives, and it turns out they're completely wrong.
Yeah,
So
that's true.
I tend to think, oh, just don't say that kind of thing. You know, it destroys people's credibility, I believe, when they try to come out with stuff like that. But you know, they only have to be wrong right once, as you say, don't they?
Yeah.
So you know,
Yeah. Well, it's the same thing
but
as I
yeah,
was
it's
talking
weird.
with, yeah, I was talking with Michael. I'm like, you know, every day somebody makes a decision in the military or somewhere. Like, you know, when they came out with the nuclear bomb, they're like, oh, well, we don't know if it lights the atmosphere on fire. Fuck it. Let's light it up. Let's see what
Yeah,
happens.
exactly. But they still did it anyway.
Yeah, CERN. They're like, oh, it might create a black hole when we activate it. Fuck it. Activate it. Like every day somebody makes decisions that could ruin the planet.
Oh, yeah.
So far, track record seems okay, but you only need to be wrong once,
Once.
right? It's the same thing with ufology, I think. And it's interesting. Like, we have to study the past to understand the future. You know, history repeats itself, and we don't have much recorded history, but we caught on pretty quick that something is happening. We're starting to write it down. So maybe my great great grandchildren might be able to make sense of what we established now. China always thinks 150 years ahead. So they plan everything for 150 years ahead, everything strategically planned. We need to start doing that with this subject as well. We're probably not going to see the fruits of our labor, but maybe several generations later will, and they'll appreciate like what to, we yeah. did at this point. And like I said, it's such a huge honor to have you on today. We'll have you on again because there's so much more to Thank talk you. About. Michael, do you have any final questions for our guest today?
Well, my consistent question is, what books do you recommend that people read who are interested in understanding the phenomenon in the way that you do? What are the ones that have like really solidified your particular approach or body of knowledge?
So yeah, I scribbled down three titles whilst we've been having a conversation tonight. So in no particular order, well, actually they are in order, I guess. John Keel's Operation Trojan Horse. So it's not a nuts and bolts book. So if you're wanting case after case after case, it's not that type of book. But John Keel was an author who tried to stretch people's kind of understanding, and he would throw things out there. And it was just, and you do actually read the book and you come away thinking, that's a really, really good point. What would that end, you know, what does that kind of mean? And that just makes that book, actually all of John Keel's books, but that one in particular. I mean, I know he wrote about Mothman and that's actually quite a good book as well, but Operation Trojan Horse, sure, yeah. Definitely get that should be an addition. You know, that should be on every ufologist library. The other one would be, the second one would be Above Top Secret by Timothy Good. It's possibly the book that got a lot of people in Britain interested in this topic back in the 1990s. And funny enough, I actually remember him being on a late night BBC radio show, one of the main radio networks in Britain, talking to the presenter, and the presenter being effectively blown away by some of the stuff that Tim Good was coming out with. You know, he was talking about Majestic 12. Now, I don't necessarily have a great deal of faith in the actual validity of those documents. However, the way he was, you know, coming across, well, not just that, but everything else about what he was talking about in ufology, it was really, really interesting. And he did actually put a lot of people on, you know, towards this topic. And the book itself is great. If you ignore the MJ-12 stuff, which is pretty minimal, but go into, you know, he does go into a lot of depth about a lot of cases.
Sizable so, as well, isn't it?
Like that's the one.
Yeah, I could kill a man with this.
I've got a different cover in mind because it comes out in different covers, but I've got the original paperback version, and it's brilliant. Yeah, it was a book I've read several times over these last three decades or so. So, yeah, it's well worth reading. And the last one, and I don't know if you've heard this one before, this is called Invisible Residence by Ivan Sanderson, and it's about USOs.
Oh.
Excellent.
Yeah, need to learn more about that.
Submerged objects.
Yeah, so that's one you should really have a look at if you're interested in that kind of thing, or if not, and you want something different to read.
Fantastic. And what are the books that what is the most recent book that you've put out? And you also have a new book coming out.
So yeah, I've just completed a book on, I mean, most of my book, well, all of my books deal with aerial encounters, so whether it's pilots or aircrew, apart from the Foo Fighters book, which is a general look at World War II. So the one I've just completed, which it hasn't officially got a title yet, I'm still waiting for the artwork and a foreword to be finished, is about the 1955-1956 aerial encounters with UFOs. But I have just last year I finished the 1953-1954 book, and that was called Intercept and Identify. And then you go back a bit, and that had it's quite a decent volume that looks at the cases over those 2 years. There is a volume for looking at the same kind of cases between 1950 and 1952. It's called Flying Saucer Fever. The foreword for that was written by one Luis Elizondo.
Oh, nice. Yeah, we've heard that name, I think.
That's, yeah, you might have heard that
unknown,
name.
Unknown, but he's making waves, yeah.
Yeah, he's a good mate, is Lou. So, yes, he wrote that for me, which I'm eternally grateful to him for. And then before that, there's a similar book looking at 1946, so again, before Kenneth Arnold, through to 1949, and that's Dawn of the Flying Saucers. And one George Knapp wrote the foreword to that as well. So I've been pretty lucky with the people who've been writing forwards.
And the person writing the foreword for your new book is secret still.
I'm not going to say who that is yet, because This person, and I was saying, who they are, but they haven't finished writing the foreword yet. I hope to get it by the end of the month. But
Sure.
people will
I'm
know
almost
who
done. I'm almost done,
people
Graham. I'm
who
almost
people
done.
will know who they are. And then in terms of the Foo Fighters book, well, that was UFOs before Roswell, so it's a European Foo Fighters 1940, 1945, which gives you some idea of what it was about. But Sean Cahill, who was one of the witnesses to the 2004 Nimitz encounters, he has a personal connection to the Foo Fighters because his dad was a B-17 waste gunner during World War II,
Oh, wow.
and he'd come across things like this. So he was, Sean said, "Yeah, I'll definitely write the foreword for that book," when he found out I was doing it. So he was only too happy to
Fantastic.
do that. So
We'll plug
yeah,
all those
so
books in the description of the video
thank you.
for our audience, and we highly recommend Graham's writing. He's an excellent researcher and a really enthusiastic guy. We're glad to have you on the show, man. We'll have you back.
Thank you.
What's nice is the passion. When somebody's passionate about something, you'll pay attention. Like if somebody's passionate about thumbnails, even though you don't care about thumbnails, the passion that they have, you're like, oh, you'll listen, you'll learn something. Ufology, that's what we need. We need passionate people. I think, we have too many people are sort of like on the somber aspect of the phenomenon. And I get that there are some pretty dark places to go, but I think being enthusiastic and saying, hey, we're learning something that is part of the universe that, we weren't aware of before. That's our new exploration. That's like, discovering new continents. It's important and we should be excited about it. So it's great to
I
have
think
someone.
the people who are just coming into the subject from, say, 2017, they've got very probably little awareness of actually what happened in the decades beforehand. So
Right.
it's important that we actually, they're brought up to speed on that because there's a whole rich history that they're just not aware of.
The
And,
tip of the
they might have
iceberg.
their, well, exactly, but they also might have their kind of own voyage of discovery. They might latch onto something that maybe nobody else has picked up on before. So it's important that people get to grips with the stuff that's happened beforehand, to obviously to repeat a well phrase from the past. Those who forget their history are condemned to repeat it. So you have to know about what's happened before so you can go forward. So yeah, it's really important that people look at this kind of stuff. And I'm not the only one. There are lots of people out there who are really interested in the history of ufology, and it's just getting that to a wider audience. So, you're part of that. So, thanks very much, both of you. Thanks very much for the
Absolutely.
invitation. I've really enjoyed this.
Oh,
Thanks for
absolutely.
being
Let's have
here.
you back on again, my man. Thank you so much, Graham.